Campus FM presents a talk organized by the CERN entitled Falling Church Attendances, Has Anything Gone Wrong? This talk is delivered by Professor Robin Gill.
Your Grace, Your Lordship, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Almost a year ago to the day, the CERN has published the preliminary report of the Sunday Mass attendance census held on November 2005. The final report is almost ready. We're only waiting for official figures as regards parish populations to be published by the NSO, because as you know, so far only local council populations have been published. However, this should not be a hindrance for an immediate pastor election on the results which have been published. As a sociologist, I would be going against the grain to ignore the importance of Christian roots. No culture, not even the religious one, is the result of a virgin birth. However, as a Christian, I firmly believe that the best indicators of faith are not our roots, but our fruits. Jesus in Matthew 7:17 told us, "Can people pick grapes from thorns or figs from thistles? In the same way, a sound tree produces good fruit, but a rotten tree bad fruit." And it is Jesus himself who insists, in an earlier chapter, in fact, in chapter 3 of St. Matthew, when he warned his contemporaries, and of course he warned us, "Do not think you can say to yourselves, we have Abraham as our father. I tell you that of these stones God can raise up children for Abraham." These words are not only wonderfully expressive, but extremely relevant. It is neither leaves nor roots which are the proper test of the life in a tree. It is not kinship which is important in matters of faith. So this principle is the principle by which we should test our faith, both as persons and as institutions. We are duty-bound to search for the reasons of absenteeism at the attendance for Sunday Mass, which, as you know, is central not only to our faith, but also to our being as Christians. Our search should extend beyond the threshold of the temples. It should be sought in our liturgical and political language, in our private and public spaces, in our speech and in our silence. To talk about these issues tonight, I have the pleasure to introduce to you Professor Robin Gill from the University of Kent in Canterbury. He is the Ramsey Professor of Modern Theology at the University of Kent and the canon and the provincial canon at the Canterbury Cathedral. He has taught for 16 years in Edinburgh and later was chair at Newcastle University. Presently, he is the Ramsey Professor of Theology, of Modern Theology, and he is also an advisor to the Archbishop of Canterbury on theology and ethics, especially medical ethics. I am sure that his wide pastoral experience and academic career should enlighten us on the way ahead. So, without much more ado, I'd like to introduce you, Professor Gill.
Thank you, Father Joe, and thank you for inviting me. It's wonderful to be here in your lovely country again. We were last here 6 years ago. On that occasion, I was preaching in the Anglican Cathedral. So it's lovely here to be with you in the Catholic Church and to share today. You're the experts on Malta, not me, and I'm not here to tell you things that you wouldn't otherwise have known about your country. What I'm going to try to do today is try to set the census that you had in 2005 and the previous censuses you've had into a wider perspective, into a perspective where we look at other European examples of censuses and try to compare and check where we are. But there's also another purpose in talking to you, and that's to try to think with you the problems of actually understanding what you're looking at. And this is where sociologists of religion have been puzzling now for the last 30 or 40 years in trying to explain exactly what is happening in our churches. Well, there are a number of options, and we'll talk about them later. But first I'm going to talk about the data itself. Perhaps before, I ought to say that I'm hugely admiring of Father Joe in the work that he's done on statistics and on church census data here in Malta. It's a very courageous thing to do. You don't usually get much thanks for it, especially when you're producing evidence that people really would rather not hear. And that's certainly been my experience and the experience of a number of other people working in the churches around the world. When we uncover uncomfortable data about our churches, it takes a good deal of courage and persistence to do that. And I think Father Joe should be hugely congratulated for doing that. Sometimes people are puzzled by me because I'm a priest, I'm an Anglican priest, but I'm also a sociologist and a theologian. And I've spent many years trying to puzzle out my own church's condition in England. And on the whole, the picture presented to the churches has not been exactly an encouraging one. And people say to me, why do you do it? Why do you try to understand? Why do you try to look at all this data when it's so depressing? I've only really got one answer, and that is because I think we ought to start with the truth. Not with how we want a thing to be, but how it is, before we can see the possibility of how we might be able to change, or perhaps even more important, what we might be able to change and what we probably can't change. I think if there's one thing that I perhaps can do a bit better than I used to do, it's being able to distinguish between what is changeable in churches and what is probably unchangeable. If at the end of this lecture and the questions, you've got a sense of that, then I'll have achieved everything I want to achieve this evening with you. I thought I'd start with a picture. It's a picture of my church, our local church in Kent. It's the Church of Hucking, a wonderfully Anglo-Saxon name. It's been there for 1,000 years. For half of its time, the first 500 years, it was a Catholic church, and for the last 500 years, it's been an Anglican church. Who knows what it will be in 500 years' time? The oddest thing about this church is that there isn't any population surrounding it. We live down the road and round the corner, and there are another 4 houses directly opposite the church, but not much else, really. There it is, in a very busy part of Kent, but set right at the top of a hill on the North Downs, overlooking a big population miles beneath, but around the church there really isn't a population. And curious enough, there never has been. It's always been a church, a parish church, seemingly without any particularly viable population. I think it's a point of contact, I think, between some of your churches here in Malta and our churches in the south of England, particularly in Kent, is that we really are surrounded by a huge luxury of historic churches and not always closely related to populations, to put it mildly. In fact, in the clergy team that I head in my part-time, so to speak, we have 4 Grade 1 historic churches, when really we need 1 church. But like you, we have this huge wealth of historic and beautiful churches. which we have, whether we want them or not. Well, just to depress you a bit, this church, beautiful little church, and that's a painting that was done in 1817, before the Victorians changed a few things, but not too many. This church still has a congregation of about 12, and they meet once a month. And about three times a year, we have a full church, just before Christmas for our carol service, sometimes for our harvest festival service, or sometimes we have a benefice service, as we call it, when we gather all the churches around and come just to this one church. But other than that, it's, I suppose, an occasional church. Occasionally, it has a service, and occasionally it has a congregation. Hucking, wonderfully Anglo-Saxon name. Well, I start with that image because it partly reminds me of what the problem is, and partly reminds me, as a Christian, as a priest, what we're in the business of trying to make sense of as well. Let me start, not with your church census, but with evidence from England particularly, which I've done my own research, and try to put to you some of the problems that we've experienced in terms of our own church-going patterns. Now, some of you will love statistics and some of you won't, but I've put them up for you. At least this is the one chart I've got, which isn't in statistical terms, as a bar chart. Now, this gives you a bird's eye view of the changes that have been taking place in church going in England. Now, like Father Joe's work, this is all based upon census data. This is actual headcounts of people. These are returns from churches of all different denominations and from local churches. This is them reporting to us how many people are there on a particular Sunday, on a typical Sunday taken over these three dates. The people who did this, not myself, but Christian Research, Peter Browley, who, like Father Joe, has for many years done statistical work on census data on churches, again in the hope to try to understand them. And he's assembled this extraordinary body of knowledge. He actually started it in 1979. We'll be seeing that in one of the later censuses. But let's try and make sense of this. Now, the first thing you'll notice is that the Catholic Church here, from Catholic Church in England, at least back in 1989, had more people in church on the census date than any other church, including the established church, the Church of England. And that by 2005, the Catholic Church and the Church of England were about equal in terms of those in church. Now, remember what we're talking about. We're not talking about a population that occasionally goes to church. If it's counted on that basis, then the Anglican Church, the Church of England, would be by far the biggest church. We're not talking in terms of people's affiliation. What if you stop them in the street and say, what religion are you, what church do you belong to, then a majority of the English population still say Church of England. Our trouble is they say that, and they're affiliated to it, but they don't often visit us. About a third of them will come once a year, but only 2% on an average Sunday. The Roman Catholic Church in England represents about 11% of the population, but as we'll be seeing, although they started at a higher base in 1989, they have declined very rapidly over the last 26 years. As you can see from this, a decline there, then, a decline there, then. Church of England, in contrast, a radical decline then, and a slightly smaller decline, or much smaller decline, within the second period of time. Now, one of the advantages of putting church-going figures in this form is that you can see the difference in the relative sizes so easily. You'll also notice something else about these patterns, that the Methodist Church, although much smaller than the Church of England, has got exactly the same pattern of decline. Smaller, again, is the United Reformed Church, a combination of Presbyterians and Congregationalists. Their figures are too small to really show this, but in fact it is a step-down process that we have there. There is one group, and I'll come back to that when I talk about Malta, where you see fairly rapid growth, and that's the Pentecostals. And you can certainly see between there and there a significant growth. We can see that almost anywhere in the world. And you can see it probably here in Malta as well. But, whoops, didn't mean to do that. But, in terms of size, they're pretty small. But they are unusual. It seems to keep doing that. I'm sorry about this. It's not meant to do that. It's probably me. But in terms of size, they're small. But they are the only religious grouping that we can see here that actually shows an increase, at least between 1989 and 2005. But this gives you at least a few balances. It suggests that there is a serious problem in England in terms of church-going, and it's not a respecter of denomination. That the Catholic Church has this problem just as much as the Anglican Church, as does the Methodist Church. And that the opposite pattern amongst Pentecostals is not nearly enough to offset the huge declines in the other denominations. This talk is going to be quite depressing for a bit, I'm afraid, and it's going to get more depressing with the next slide. This, I think, is probably the most worrying slide I have to show you this evening. This is the age distribution among churchgoers of any denomination. So it takes churchgoers, whatever denomination they belong to, and we can see that the process of decline here in terms of the adult population, percentage of the adult population in church on this on the particular Sundays in question, back in 1979 it was 12%, just under 12% as it happens. Bring it forward 26 years to 2005, and what we see is it is approximately halved. It's actually slightly more than 6% and slightly less than 12%. But in rough and ready terms, we're talking about a halving over a period of 26 years. That's the position we're looking at with the other slide. But look at this. The average age of churchgoers has increased. It was 37, 38, then 43, but it's now 45. Look at the age groups up here. What we find is we take any age group below mid-40s, and we find, as a percentage of churchgoers, it always declines. Look at this, 26, 25, 19, 19. The 15 to 19-year-olds, the group that's most missing from our churches in England, 9%, 7%, 6%, 5%. 20 to 29, 11, 10, 9, 7. They're so consistent, these figures. Only when we come to the 30 to 44-year-olds do we find this beginning to stop. And then you move to the older age groups, 45 to 64, we find it's increasing, 20, 22, 24, 24. The 65 group, and this is really not good news for any church, 18, 19, 25, 29. When I was doing my own research on English churchgoing, I did it for the 19th and the 20th century using census data. I discovered one occasion in the beginning of the first half of the 20th century when a serious social scientist tried to look at trends in a place and then make predictions for the future, which I was able to test. It was the Roundtrees, very famous researchers on poverty and other things, but they were also interested in the churches. And
What Rountree did was he looked at York at three points in the first half of the 20th century until he died. And then he made predictions about what would happen in the next 50 years. I was able to do exactly the same thing as he'd done 50 years later and test his predictions, and they were absolutely right. They were based largely upon a single factor, the age distribution within churches in York. And what he found, that among the free churches, there was an absence of young people, the congregations were getting fairly elderly. This was true to a lesser extent, but it was still true of the Church of England. It wasn't true at that stage of the Catholic Church in York. Rountree predicted that in 50 years' time, the free churches would be radically cut, the Church of England would decline, but the Catholics wouldn't. And broadly speaking, that's what happened. In fact, the process in the Catholic Church we'll be seeing was just a bit later. But it was based upon this single identifying feature, the age profile of churchgoers. Let's look at the implications of this, because this again is another depressing chart, I'm afraid. Here in England, I was able to compare over a 40-year period of time, just over a 40-year period of time, those who, in questionnaire surveys, we're no longer talking about census data here, questionnaire surveys, who were stopped in the street and asked, what is your religion? Actually, the question was a bit more sophisticated than that. If you stop somebody in the streets, in almost any country, and say, what is your religion, you'll get quite a high return rate. And those who say no religion will be quite small. Even in England, only about 10% will actually do it. If you put it to them more gently and say, if you have a religion, what might it be? Putting it a bit more gently and a bit more subtly, you get much higher rates of people saying, I don't have any. Now, as it happened, Goro, quite a big survey done in 1950, a very early questionnaire survey, asked the question in the same way that the British Social Attitudes, our main body of expert evidence about people's attitudes, they both asked the question in this gentle way. If you have a religion, what might it be? Asked this question in 1950, there isn't any discernible difference between the different age cohorts. They're extremely flat, as you can see, 22, 22, 24, 22, 22, 24, with a mean of 23. Move it on just three decades later, what we find is a radically different pattern. The oldest group, the 65-plus group, only 15% of them come up with this, well, I don't have a religion. But the youngest group, and this is seriously worrying, the youngest group has a majority saying they don't have any religion. Move it on to another 10 years, and we find that this is still true. In fact, the cohorts pretty well carry a cross. So if you think there's a 30-year gap, then you move from here down to here, down to here, you see that hasn't changed. It's still 22, 21%. What's happening is it's the youngest age groups which are no longer seeing themselves having a religion. Again, radically serious evidence in terms of the English situation. If you don't like statistics, I've put into bullet form a summary of my own research on church going in 20th century England. I've taken it back much further than that. I've taken it back into the 19th century. It's solely based upon, or mostly based upon, census data. I think in England they were doing censuses of churchgoers, mostly once done by the government in 1851, but afterwards, after that, done by newspapers. I think they were doing it earlier than anywhere else in the world. I've not found any evidence of anybody else doing it quite this early. But if you take the evidence accumulatively, by 1900, what was happening in England is a number of things. That urban, adult, Anglican and free church going was already declining. In fact, the Anglicans had been declining for 50 years by then in urban areas in terms of church going. The free churches were about 20 or 30 years. There were still pockets of suburban and rural resilience. Sunday schools were still very strong. But the rural churches were facing radical problems of overbuilding and depopulation. Father Joe mentioned my book, The Myth of the Empty Church, but in that book, I made the odd discovery, which I didn't expect to find, was that in rural areas of England, by 1900, typically speaking, they had more places in church, in their churches, more seats in their churches, than they had people in the surrounding population. We'd actually competed so furiously, we'd actually built so many churches of competing denominations, that we actually had more seats in our churches than there were people in the population. In fact, in parts of Wales, Machynlleth in Wales, there was provision by 1900 for 300% of the population of Machynlleth. Well, you really don't have to be any kind of statistician to realize that once you've got provision of 300% of seats in your church for the local population, then even if every person at the beginning of life and at the end of life, whether ill or well or rest of it, even if every person was dragged into church on a Sunday, no church could have been, on average, more than a third full. It's odd, isn't it, that we do these things? But this was completely invisible to the Victorians themselves. Nobody ever noticed this. I was swapping notes before we started, and one of the things that whenever I talk about church-going decline, people always know the answer. They always say, it's X or Y. I looked up some of the registers of the Anglicans. This was in an area where there'd been radical depopulation, where the churches had competed furiously and carried on building against each other with radical depopulation. And I looked up the registers of the churches to see what they thought the reason was for their decline in church going. The local priest thought it was the invention of the bicycle, that young people were going on their bikes these days. The bishop, when he came and visited and wrote in blue pencil in the margins of the register, simply said, "This priest could try harder." What nobody had noticed was that the population was now a fifth of what it was before, and that they'd been building churches furiously of all sorts of denominations against each other, and overbuilt. It never occurred to them. But the bicycle and not trying hard enough, those pretty well occurred to them straight away. If we did the same thing today, I'm sure we'd talk about tourism or television or the films or the motor car or whatever it is. There's never any shortage of reasons. By 1919, most soldiers in the First World War, we know this from a very early census, the earliest, I think, anywhere in the world, not census, a questionnaire survey, that most soldiers in the First World War had been to Sunday school as children. They had residual Christian beliefs in prayer, particularly in God, not particularly in Jesus Christ, but they'd never been regular churchgoers as adults back home. We now begin to see this extraordinary situation in England, even by 1919, of chapels and mission halls and in synagogues as well, as happens, in urban areas beginning to close. By 1950, Catholics had become a major force amongst churchgoers. Well, we saw that in the pie chart, in the bar chart. Sunday school attendances and confirmations are still relatively high, albeit declining. There's pockets of resilient church going in some deeply rural areas, but slight rise in church going in middle class suburban areas. There's generalized Christian belief is still relatively strong, otherwise decline continued. By 1970, Catholics, as we saw in our bar chart, had begun to decline. Sunday school attendances and confirmations declining fast. Christian beliefs started to decline. Minority religious beliefs persisted. Independent churches and mosques, now we're getting Muslims, growing in urban areas. Older churches were declining fast in rural and urban areas. By 2002, independent churches no longer all growing. Persistence in Pentecostal churches, and indeed outside Christianity and Muslim mosques, albeit on the part of Pentecostals to be highly vociferous, to split very easily and keep forming new congregations. One last thing about England, and then I'll move to Malta, and more encouraging, I think. Although our church-going pattern is not encouraging, and almost universally, one of the things that we've found is that those who do go to church, there is a difference in their behaviour. When I first started doing this part of my research, my more secular colleagues said to me, well, you're going to find one of two things, either that going to church has no effect upon people's behaviour or moral belief, or secondly, it does, and churchgoers are more racist and sexist than other people. Well, I wasn't very keen on this notion on their part, but I said, no, it's not my job to second-guess these things. I want to study it. I want to know what the situation is. Actually, I think it is much more encouraging. If you actually take church-going and something like voluntary work in the community, there's a very strong correlation between those who are active in the church and those who are active in the community at large. As you can see, going to church, and particularly in the middle age group, those who go to church once a week across denominations, Catholics, Protestants, Anglicans, significantly different to those who never go to church, and even more different from those who have no religion. There's a sevenfold difference. Okay, so how does all this relate to Malta? Well, I think you'll be aware from your press of these figures here. Let's not talk about Gozo for the moment. Gozo is important. It shows a path of decline, but not nearly so radical as that in Malta. And you can see the population, the decline keeps jumping. Here going from 82% to 73% to 62% down to just 51% now. I say just. I think I could only say just in Malta. Because if I was talking to almost any other country in the world, they'd say 50%, wow. I think you have to keep this in perspective. And that's pretty important. I mean, given that I'm talking about 6 or 7% in England, 51% in Malta looks pretty good to me. As it happened, I compared this to Gibraltar. I had a reason for doing this. My father was a Gibraltarian. My family were in Gibraltar for over 150 years. And I was there last month. So I thought I'd do a bit of similar work in Gibraltar. I couldn't begin to replicate what Father Joe did, getting returns from all the congregations. Instead, I talked to the senior clergy across denominations in Malta and got them to estimate. It's a bit dangerous because I'm probably hearing a really good Sunday rather than an average Sunday. So the Gibraltarian figures, probably a bit too high, to be honest. But nevertheless, it does show a trend. If you compare them with, compare Malta, 51%, 50.7%, Gibraltar, 16.7%. Gibraltar, 78% of the population is Catholic. It's a bit lower than Malta, but it's still quite a Catholic place. And it's got some of the some similarities in terms of history. And the estimates for the past suggest, again, there's been a radical decline here. If you take English Catholics, again, we can see a pattern very similar again. In fact, the English Catholic attendance is pretty similar to Gibraltar. 40% of those, of the 11% of the population, remember, in England, who are Catholics, 40% of them going to church back in 1967 on a particular Sunday. Nowadays, down to 17.7. And we'll begin to note, right, English Catholics here back in 1967, Maltese Catholics here in 2005. Is this going to be the projection that we might see in the future? Let's test that. Let's look at the different denominations in Malta. These are fairly rough and ready, because I'm not entirely sure of your levels of affiliation. I'm not sure anybody is in Malta. In Gibraltar, these have been asked, so let's look at Gibraltar first. In their 2005 government census, asked people what their denomination was, what church do you belong to? And we can then measure their actual church going, which is here, against affiliations. What we find is that the Catholics, of course, as churchgoers, very dominant in terms of the overall number of churchgoers, but this 16%, 0.3 here. Anglicans, pretty small, as we'll see here in Malta, 2.3. Pentecostals, 3.8, certainly becoming a significant group, but pretty small in terms of the overall numbers. Methodists and Presbyterians there as well. Moving to Malta now, let's see if we can get approximately figures again. 53.1% is my estimate of Catholics affiliations, Anglican 6.7, and all the free churches together 11.3. That's setting alongside those who we know go to church against what we think their proportions are in the population at large. That's what that is trying to do. We can see, of course, in terms, when I was measuring, there is a time difference here, and it could be your Pentecostal church has got rather larger than when I saw it, when it was in several different groups, but there were several different groups, but together they amounted to no more than about 100 people. I think it may be quite a bit larger than that now, but I haven't been able to test that. And I did that about 8 years ago. A worrying chart is here in terms of the rate of change. I don't know why it keeps doing this. I can't stop it doing this. Catholic change per year. And this, I think, is perhaps one of your most important statistics we have. The rate of change is accelerating. The rate of decline, that is, in the Catholic Church here in terms of church going. So if you take the average per year, it's increased, the decline that is, from 0.61 down to 1.1 here. In fact, your 1.1 annual rate of decline is approximately similar to the overall rate of decline we were seeing in England about 30 years earlier. It then increased to 2.4 and has stabilized slightly, but only slightly, at 2.1. That's still quite a sharp rate of decline. If you take the Catholic rate of decline in England, we see that they have accelerated hugely in England. A very worrying trend for Catholics in England. 1.4, coming now to 4.0. Now, again, the question, is this accelerating decline we see in Malta the beginning of the process here that we can see in England with the Catholics, where it becomes a rate of 4% in another few decades? Is there any evidence to suggest this? Change in mobility, I think, is one of the things that does begin to suggest this. I was looking at all the different factors that you have in your census data. Change in mobility is a pretty significant finding. That's the percentage of residents attending Mass in other parishes. Now, that's something we can find worldwide and is often associated with decline. We can find it back in urban England, back into the 17th century and 18th century. In rural areas, I would estimate that it's a fairly recent phenomenon we've experienced in England in rural areas. That's people not going to their local church, but going to another church. What we find here in Malta, at least, is that this is accelerating. There's a shifting gender basis as well. Now, that churchgoers are more female than male. We've noticed the elderly. What we're also seeing here is evidence, particularly in Malta, of a pattern that is beginning to near the gender imbalance that we see in England as well. What about the age cohort? Because this is the most worrying one of the lot, in my view. Now, we're not looking at a trend here. What we're looking at is a single point, a single snapshot. But it does suggest that the older age groups are disproportionately represented amongst churchgoers, particularly in Malta. And that is exactly what we would find at the same point in England. These older age groups representing a disproportionate number of churchgoers, whereas the youngest age groups not represented enough in the churches. That's a very sharp warning sign. What about this statistic, which on face value looks quite a comforting statistic? Those who attended Mass last Sunday. Now, of course, this is a good statistic from the church's point of view, because it suggests that most of the people who go to church regularly. So 90% of those who went to church in Malta said, yes, indeed, they'd attended Mass last Sunday. Well, yes, it is an encouraging statistic in terms of the internal life of the church, but in terms of the country at large, it's an extremely worrying statistic, because it suggests that those who go to church, half of the population which does go to church, are most, for the most part, regular churchgoers, which suggests that there's a very substantial proportion of the population who are not regular churchgoers at all. And that's the warning sign I think it signals. If 90% of the regular churchgoers go every week, then we could be pretty sure that something like a third, two-fifths of the population really isn't going to church much at all. So what looks like a reasonably encouraging statistic actually turned out to be anything but, which takes me back to my church at Hucking. What I want to do briefly now, having depressed you all with those statistics, is to try to put this into a more adequate theoretical framework. And I produce this green paper here, which do please take away and read, but let me briefly explain it. Many sociologists, as Father Joe will know, confronted with all this evidence, would simply say what we have here in Malta is the beginnings, not just the beginnings, but we have clear evidence of a process of secularization. Although you're doing astonishingly well in terms of half of the population still going regularly to church, you still have a substantial proportion of the population which is getting increasingly secularized. Secularization theory, which has certainly been very attractive among sociologists, really says that secularization happens because people lose religious faith. For whatever reason, whether it's wars, whether it's science, whether it's new knowledge, whether it's better education, people lose faith. And then they stop attending church. Secularization, then, is something that has gradually swept across Europe, has left some pockets like Malta and Poland and, until recently, Ireland, but that gradually it subsumes all. That might be the case. I've always resisted this theory on a number of grounds, and one of them is that worldwide it really doesn't work too well. Across Europe it works extremely well, but worldwide it doesn't work particularly well. Another theory is persistence theory. And this, I suppose, is a kind of optimistic theory of religion. It says that, well, persistence, religion is a staple part of human nature. We are inevitably religious, whether we want to be or not, but we may over time change the way we express religion. But religion is ubiquitous. Religious beliefs some form of religious practice, some form of religious behavior is just part of the human condition. So what we'd expect then is that one form of religion, church going, will be replaced by another. Well, maybe. It's very difficult to prove big theories like that. An extremely influential set of theories has argued something quite different, what they call separation. And they say, well, actually, what we can find in Europe, in every country, and I'm sure Malta is no exception, is we can find all sorts of people who never go to church or very seldom go to church, but still have Catholic beliefs and still pray regularly and still think of themselves as Christians and still have these beliefs. Certainly in England, where just 6% of the population are going to church on a regular basis, two-thirds of the country still say they believe in God. It's not quite as optimistic as that. Only one-third believe in a personal God. But even that's much bigger than our church-going rate. So separation theory says, well, these things can go on separately. I've become less convinced about this because I think with a couple of American sociologists, I think I've been able to prove that, sadly, religious belief, or at least Christian belief, is on the decline in Britain and has been over the last 50 years. My theory is what I call cultural theory. And it's really quite a straightforward theory. It simply says this, that people go to church and they learn to believe. Through exposure to worship and preaching and sermons and scripture and the liturgy, and that is how belief is formed, and that is how belief is carried forward from one generation to another. But the negative side of this is this. If we actually see that significant parts of our young population are not going to church, then what we must expect is that significant parts of our young population will not be schooled in belief either, and that we can't automatically accept that they will carry the beliefs of the previous generation if they're not sharing in any of the practices. If that theory is true, I think it's quite a strong wake-up call to the churches. Because what it suggests is this, that, our faith may continue with an older generation that was schooled in the faith, even when that older generation themselves become somewhat lax about church-going. But we can't assume that that's going to carry forward into the future. I probably ought to stop at this point and let you ask the questions, both about my analysis and what we might think of in terms of what we might actually do about any of this. But do you want me to stop at that point, or do you want me to address that, what do we do about any of this first, or shall I let people sort of draw breath and ask me questions first? Okay. Yep.
My name is Eddie, and it's not so much of a question which I want to ask, but it's more of an input rather than... Because just now when you've said that many people are being taught to believe in something, then I just now had the realization that we've all been taught to believe in something, but we haven't been taught to, in a sense, to activate our spirit in relating with God. It's like going to school, like you're being taught to pass an exam. You've fed all the information in. It's like we've been taught to say, for instance, the rosary. We recite the rosary over and over again. But then we don't ask ourselves sort of, you know, what is it I'm saying? I'm reciting these words, but nothing's happening internally. And I think... personally, actually, people should be encouraged to kind of make a connection spiritually with Jesus or God or what they believe in, and then, in a sense, to activate their creativity and talk to God in a personal way. Meaning, when in such a way, praying in a sense, in a way, to asking God, "Why am I here? You know, I've been going to church all my life." And I never asked myself, well, what is my purpose? What is my value? And if there is a life after death, you know, why are my senses sort of not pursuing this.
Yes.
These thank goals.
You. Yeah, thank you. That's good. Yes. I think I would rather personally see it not like schooling as learning things, but as nurturing within a family. Somebody who's never been nurtured within a family and knows nothing about love is unlikely to be able to express love, is unlikely to be able to share love with others. But we know that if we can nurture our children in loving families, then there is a good chance that that person may in turn be able to express that love to their own children and so forth in the future. So I see it more like nurturing rather than teaching, that the churches are there to nurture people in the faith. But I think that much says much the same as you did. Thank you. Yeah.
Can we point to ourselves, we priests, we teachers of religion, catechism classes, we parents or others who forge the minds and hearts of our children and youth, are we speaking about our obligations towards God, particularly Sunday observance? Because I've lately come across instances where an adult, not an old man, but an adult, claims that he's not aware that it is obligatory. I am aware that obligation might be considered by some as more repelling than compelling. That might be so with some, but not with most. And I think pointing to an obligation is a must, especially when people are being trained to understand what is morally correct and not. Because nowadays, even basic moral principles are being discussed and being put in the mass media and thereby are being considered by the masses as almost optional whether to adhere to them or not. So I think being clearly spoken about these matters is conducive to a better appreciation of the situation and of our obligations, and we have to point it out. And also the moral part of it. Sinfulness, for instance, there has been a claim that the greatest sin nowadays is the lack of the sensibility, lack of understanding that there is sinfulness around us, and the loss of the sense of sin. So there might be a loss of a sense of obligation too, and yes, that might be in part, not totally, conducive to falling church attendance.
I think you're absolutely right about that. I think one of the biggest shifts we've seen in England, and I suspect, but you must tell me, you've seen here in Malta, is a shift from obligation in terms of church going as a sense of duty, to church going as something that you do when you want to do it, and when you feel a need for it, and when it is meaningful to you. I think that is a straightforward generational shift. There's all sorts of big factors out there, I think, which have caused this, but it is highly significant, certainly amongst many of the young people I talk to. They're quite mystified by a sense of obligation or duty. I think I'm increasingly odd in English society as somebody feels a duty bound to go to church on a Sunday, every Sunday. We see this shift in our own congregations as well, but you must be seeing something of this as well. In terms of my congregation, I expect to see members of that congregation about every other week. There's a small group at the heart of the church who will be there every week, but it's very small. The majority of our congregation is every other week. Now, I think we can do one of two things about this. We can beat our own breast about this and say the fault is entirely the priests, or the fault is entirely the church, or we can say, and this is what I'm trying to encourage you to think of, there's actually a bigger trend out there which we're probably fairly powerless to change. This is changing over a generational process. I think there are some opportunities with this, but it's not quite the church we've inherited. It is a church in which they won't be there every Sunday. They will be more demanding about what they expect from the church. They'll probably be more critical of the church and the process. But I also think it's something we can live with. My little church here is still there. Okay, there's a small congregation there. The regular congregation is really pretty small. But once or twice a year, it does actually get pretty well everybody in the population to come to one of its services. Our Christmas service, for example, which is very rare in England, really does get pretty well everybody in the local population. I think I can't think of a single household that that church serves where somebody doesn't come to church once a year. Now, that's not a very strong commitment, but in English terms, it's quite unusual. And it does seem to me one small way in which we think we really are trying to hand something on to the future. Of course, there are some things we can do as churches to improve our situation. Of course, we can make our churches more friendly. We can make them more welcoming. We can track people more carefully. We can encourage them, of course. We can try and school them and train them and all those things. Nonetheless, there are big changes that are happening right across Europe, which we're probably fairly powerless to actually change wholly. In Canterbury Diocese, we have a particular active policy on mission, as is proper for the Canterbury Diocese and the Anglican Church. We have new initiatives, a whole program of new initiatives that churches are trying to explore, including having youth ministers in nightclubs and so forth from our churches. Those new initiatives are very important. They're very important to build webs with a larger community. But they don't actually stop our overall church-going decline. They ease it up a bit. They halt it a bit. But we haven't yet found any magic way of actually getting over this generational difference of a generation that in the past felt an obligation and in the present really doesn't feel an obligation, even though they sometimes feel a need. But that's quite a big shift. And I think it's something that I suspect is here in Malta as well. But like it or not, I think we've got to live with that. I think that's where we are at the moment, at least. But it doesn't mean the disappearance of the church. But it does mean I suspect, going to face quite radical changes in our patterns of church going in the future.
I think I would have loved to hear some reasons as to why church attendance in England has fallen. With regard to Malta, I think one of the major reasons may have been that going to church, to Mass, is not an experience of joy. And if that joy is missing, then people get frustrated. I look at the faces of people in Sunday Mass and they're all yawning. And I've had the good fortune of living overseas for 20 years. I lived in big European countries, France, Italy, Belgium, where Masses were very similar to Malta. But I lived also in the States and in England, and I found there that the experience was really joyful. The welcome you got as you went to the church, the homily, the positive attitude of the priest, the way the congregation was praised by the priest for things it had done during the week, you know, the mentioning of members of the community who had done something good, all this, and plus the coffee and sandwiches after Mass. Now, people might say this is impossible in Malta because our churches are too big. You can't handle it. I don't know. But I think we could try. I think joy is the key to making church attendance a success. And I'd love to see that when we take a second census on church attendance, we really have to ask the non-churchgoers, yeah, why aren't they going? Because that's very important. Then we can start addressing the issue. And you would be shocked if you had to look even further at the decrease in attendance, because when I was growing up, church attendance was a daily thing. We went to Mass every single day. Now, you're lucky if you see somebody going once a week. So you know, the relevance of the Mass has declined a lot. Perhaps they find it repetitive and therefore boring. Maybe we need to reinvent the Mass. I don't know.
Okay. Thank you for that. I agree with a lot of that. And again, I think it's exactly the difference. America particularly, church going is not an obligation. It's a lifestyle choice. It's something that you choose to do. Now, of course, that has a loss about it, but it also has a bit of enthusiasm as well. There's no question of that. And I think that's probably what we're experiencing now. Most of our churchgoers are choice churchgoers, not duty churchgoers. But it doesn't stop the decline, I'm afraid. One point I would make, and I think if you buy into my cultural theory, this is one of the interesting features of it, is that everybody thinks and has told me the problem is the problem is why do churches decline? I think we may have got that the wrong way around. I think we probably ought to ask ourselves, why do some churches grow? Now, when you ask it in that form, I think you can actually see there are certain patterns around the world. South Korea, the Protestant churches and the Catholic Church, and as it happens, the Buddhist religion, all grew rapidly in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And everybody said, they've found the magic answer. And then it stopped. 1990, it stopped. And has been declining since. Now, I've been looking at this around the world. I don't think it's anywhere that always grows. The natural position for churches is to decline because it's difficult to pass on beliefs from one generation to another. What happens in some places at certain points in history, and it's usually associated with strong mobility of population, and in America it's heavily associated with immigration, large amounts of immigrants strengthening their churches, Catholics from South America now, Hispanic Catholics helping the church to grow there, Presbyterians from Korea helping the Presbyterian church to grow there. If you take out those immigrant groups, then they're not actually much different to the rest of us. Some things promote growth, mobility, migration, rapid urbanization and then suburbanization. All those things I think are strongly associated with growth. When none of those things are happening, when the population isn't moving, when the population is relatively static, when the population is not being threatened by an outside people as they were in Poland, when none of those things are happening, then slow decline is our natural position, so to speak. But just occasionally we get a boost because something happens, one of those other things happens. That's the way I see it. So I don't feel so depressed about church going to decline. I think it's part of the life cycle of a long life cycle over centuries of how churches operate. They will sometimes increase if the physical things are in place. But the rest of the time, they can certainly slow the decline down by acting appropriately, as you suggest, but it's very difficult to stop it.
I wouldn't be of the idea that we have to water down what we expect of our relationship with God. Being happy that you are increasing the number of people coming and saying, I'm happy because they come twice a year. Because I think that what is important is the kind of relationship that one is seeking. And I can't envisage a real commitment if you only go once or twice a year. And I think that is going to make a difference. The kind of relationship, because I think the majority, they would say that they believe in God. In Malta, I think the percentage is 95%. The problem is committing oneself to having a proper relationship with God, who is God. And that means, I mean, rather than being just worried about church attendance, perhaps we would be worried about what kind of relationship people are seeking to the Lord. Sometimes it is a selfish relationship with the Lord, letting him be over there, knowing that he will help you when you want to. But I do think that was the relationship, especially in the primitive church. Because in the primitive church, where statistics were much worse than they are now.
Oh, sure.
And that was a challenge. And from that moment that they understood it as a challenge, those who are outside are a challenge to those who are inside. And I think that what we search for rather than numbers is, first of all, having a deeper commitment, a deeper identity of who one is. And then passing through, I think, not the model of 50 years back, because we can't just stay with that. That isn't true nowadays, as you were saying. But in the primitive church, Christians knew that if you had the grace of knowing about Christ, it means also accepting it as the good news and trying to also to convey it to others. So that even though the traditional, what you mentioned, the traditional way of looking to traditions and families, etc., we have to look at another way. It has to be a welcoming church rather than just conserving what it has. I think that is one of the great challenges that we have today, I think.
Yeah, well, I wholly agree. Thank you.
Yes, thank you for your talk. You mentioned at one point the correlation between those who are committed in the church, the voluntary work, and their commitment. Could you just expand on that point, please?
Yes. I told you about my secular friends who thought what I'd found that church going made no difference. I really found it made a difference at three levels. It made a significant difference in terms of Christian belief, that those who were most active in going to church tended to be the most orthodox in their Christian beliefs. I found that it also had a strong influence upon their sense of purpose or telos, purpose or direction in their life. Those who went to church had a much stronger sense of life having meaning and purposeful, and there's a point to life. And the third group was I found that they were also more altruistic, that they were more prepared to be volunteers in the community. They thought of themselves as being more honest. They were more prepared to do things which were sacrificial in terms of giving and so forth in the community. Now, these differences were all relative, and this in part encourages me, although, like the Archbishop, I'm not too keen on people coming twice a year, but I'd rather they came twice a year than no times a year, was that these differences of belief between churchgoers and non-churchgoers were always relative. It wasn't that the non-churchgoers didn't have these values, it's that they had them less than those who went to church. It wasn't, as we all know, that everybody who goes to church is altruistic or purposeful or coherent in their beliefs. We know that's not true. He's not saying either of those things. These things are relative differences within our population. It also makes me think that the English population that this was tested on, who've had much, much lower church-going rates than Malt has experienced for many, many years, you've got to go back to the 1850s to find anything as high as the church-going rate in England compared with Malta today, that nonetheless, over a period of 150 years, there is still, thank God, an embedding of these values. They're weaker in the non-church-going population than the church-going population, but they're not absent. I think that's pretty important. And I think it's a sort of sign of encouragement that these things will persist, even in times of low church-going. We don't really understand historic trends on church-going enough. And we have hints from the past, but it isn't until 200 years ago that we have anything like statistics on this. But we do have hints from the past that there have been waves to and fro in terms of more and less active church going in the past. I'm encouraged, certainly in England, that after 150 years of declining church going, we nonetheless still have a culture that does show some of the signs which I'd expect of a Christian culture. So stronger amongst churchgoers, but not absent amongst non-churchgoers.
I feel there's a certain sense of awareness coming down upon the earth, which is, if it's the Spirit of God and the churches are sort of slowly emptying, maybe God is trying to tell us something, that we should move on to higher things, or it's like the church has so far fulfilled a certain sense of responsibility, like a stepping stone towards higher thing, where God wants to meet man directly.
I think that's true, and I think we're all in Europe, I think, watching these patterns very carefully. I think I want to pass on the message to you. I mean, that I think you are part of the larger trends that are happening in Europe, but still where you are now is still very remarkable in the modern world. We don't know the end story, and none of us are going to be around to see it. The church, even in my country, is going to survive me. So I think the church in Malta, I think, is going to survive all of you as well. We don't know the future, but we can try to look at the trends. That's all we can do. And not to be too discouraged by them. I mean, these are in part out of our control. There are some things we can do, of course. We can make our services more engaging. We can deepen our spirituality. We can make people feel more welcome. We can pay much more attention to young people. We can look to fresh expressions in our churches. All of these things are within our control. The big social processes, I fear, are not. But they happen over many centuries. At the moment, Malta is still in quite a privileged position. I suspect the changes already in place here and will emulate those of the rest of Europe, but I may be wrong about that. But I don't think that's something to beat your breasts about. I think we can learn from each other, I think, in this respect, and also learn that even in England, where we've had a long process of church-going decline, we haven't lost all of our Christian culture. That's important, I think.
Okay, thank you very much, Professor Gill. I'm tempted to stretch a bit the concept, Turner's concept of liminality in his explanation of ritual, in the sense that Turner speaks of ritual, and liturgy is a ritual, and the mass is a major ritual of the church, in a vertical sense. That is, in ritual we are on the threshold between heaven and earth, in a sense. That is, Turner takes it more in a vertical sense. I think we should look deeper also and look at at our ritual, at our liturgies, and look at liminality in an horizontal sense. That is, whether we are in or out of institutionalized religion, of religiosity, of spirituality. Of course, concepts tend to become fuzzier, so it's very difficult to quantify. But I think it is along these lines also that we should study the situation of church attendance, whether those who attend Mass feel that they are on the doorstep of heaven or on the doorstep of leaving their faith. Thank you very much.
You have just listened to a talk organized by the CERN entitled Falling Church Attendances. Has Anything Gone Wrong? This talk was delivered by Professor Robin Gill.